this is a very special reading because it's part of the events on the theme of refugee and migrant experiences. First of all, thank you to the Arts Council UK and to the Swedish Arts Council to give funding for events like this. Now I'm going to briefly introduce the two poets reading for us and Caroline Smith, who is chairing the event. Athena Farrokhzad, that was very hard to learn the pronunciation, was born in 1983 in Tehran and lives in Stockholm. She's a poet, literary critic, translator, playwright, and teacher of creative writing. After several years of collaborative poetry projects and international literary work, she published her first very shiny volume of poetry, Witzwit, White Blight, in 2013 at Albert Bernier's Verlag. Witzwit received several literary awards and was translated and still is being translated into different languages such as Danish, Norwegian, Romanian, English, Chinese, Spanish, Arabic, and so on. And it is also performed as a play at the Swedish Radio Theatre and at Unga Klara Theatre. She teaches creative writing at Bishop's Arnus Författerskola and has translated writers such as Adrian Rich, Marguerite Duras, Monique Wittig, and Nicole Brossard into Swedish. In 2016, her second volume of poetry, Trado, written together with the Romanian poet Svetlana Karstin, was published. Now, our second poet today, Amir Darwish, is a British-Syrian poet and writer of Kurdish origin. Born in Aleppo, he came to Britain as an asylum seeker in 2003. He completed an MA at Durham University before he moved to London, where he currently lives and writes. Amir published work in the UK, the USA, Pakistan, Finland, Turkey, and Mexico. And last but not least, Caroline Smith, our chair, was born in Ilford in Essex and now lives in Wembley. She graduated with a BA in Fine Arts from Goldsmiths College in London, and her first publication was the much-praised long narrative poem Edith, published by Flambert Press. Her debut collection, Thistles of the Hesperides, was shortlisted for the Aldborough Festival First Collection Prize. Caroline Smith has also been widely published in poetry journals, and she was a recipient of an Eastern Arts Writers Bursary and twice a prize winner in the Troubadour Poetry Competition. Her latest collection, The Immigration Handbook, is forthcoming from Sarin in summer 2016. Welcome all three of them to the stage.
The way we'd structure this evening is for the first part for me to ask a few questions of each of these wonderful and interesting poets, and then for each of them to read some of their work, and if there's time at the end for questions from all of us here. So I was going to start with you, Amir. And one of the things that I've always wondered about writers such as yourself, who started writing in one country and now finds themselves living and writing in another, is what language do you think in? Do you imagine your poems in Arabic first and then translate them into English, either in your head or on the paper? And or do they now come to you in English? Because there seems to me to be very different rhythms and styles between the two languages.
Mm. Okay, interesting question. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Well... mother languages are usually stored in certain part of the brain, but the second, third, fourth language is stored in a different part. So the mother language will always inform the imagination, as imagination happens instinctively. That's only, of course, my opinion. It's difficult, perhaps, for any poet to start the imagination with a different language than the language of the mother language. But the thinking process and the writing process are two different things than the imagination process. For me, the thinking underwriting happens in English, but the imagination is informed by the mother language, which is the language that I've learned as a child.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
What is the difference between imagining and thinking?
Okay.
Because
imagination happens instinctively. Perhaps people, they don't have a choice over it. But the thinking process sometimes, well, some people, they say they can, others they say they can't. They can't choose what to think about and not to think about. But the imagination is a different process. I don't know.
Oh, I see.
I imagine so.
Or you think.
Your first book, Don't Forget the Couscous, with its title poem Story, has been much discussed and widely acclaimed, but I think tonight we're going to hear from your new work, your autobiographical narrative from Aleppo Without Love, which is forthcoming in 2017. And you said in a recent interview, if someone from the region can explore the theme of peace, the theme of humanity, the theme of immigration as a universal humanitarian crisis, it's not a crisis for the Syrian people or a crisis for a certain group. It is a universal crisis. And I wonder if you could talk about this in relation to the recent developments in your work and the direction your poetry is now taking you in.
I'm glad you mentioned the last collection, my collection, Don't Forget the Couscous, and particularly the poem, Sorry. I feel sorry that I wrote that poem. I regret writing it. And there hasn't been an acknowledgement of how that poem really can be read up until when it was already on the page. And after that, I realized the poem can be, of course, read in so many different ways. None of them is the way that I wanted it to be read. So I attracted to themes that can really be more closer to universal message than they are into the message of a certain group or a certain place or social norm. And that's how the direction my work took, towards the themes of love, peace, and humanity. And the region, in particular to the region, suffers. The region suffers at the moment from stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And many images are coming across on screens. They do with violence, etc. So it is perhaps good for someone to bring new image, an image that can be more closer to the universal human message, which is love and peace.
So do you no longer see the job as a poet to be critical? Because it seems to me that you're in a unique position as being part of two cultures to turn a critical eye on both of them. And I just wonder if you don't anymore see that as the role of the poet, or maybe just your poetry, but the poet in general.
The poet doesn't have to be critical to be a poet. What is, just as an opinion, I don't tell poets what to write or how to write or how they should think. No one can tell anyone how they should think. But what is more important to the poet, perhaps, than to be critical, is to identify the right message to send out. And often, messages that are geographically specific or group specific or certain ideology specific, they are easier to identify than messages that are universal. So the meaning is, the trick, this is the better way to put it, is how to write a poem important to someone in China as much as it is important to someone in England, as much as it is important to someone in Africa in 2019.
And just one more question. A lot of the people that I work is immigration and asylum caseworker, and a lot of the people that come to the surgeries are completely voiceless. They don't want to be heard. They are afraid of being heard. They, you know, they hide in a sort of shadow parallel land. And I was just wondering, did you lose your voice when you arrived, or did you bring it with you, or did you find it again quickly?
When first arrival, it's just like any other human being trying to find a new voice, a new way, a new foot on the path for the new road ahead. So I suppose I lost the old voice, and there has been development in the new voice, and the process is happening again and again. It's just the progress that happened with the humans. Things change all the time as it happens, as it goes along life.
Yeah. Right. I'll just ask Athena a few questions. Do you want to ask Amir anything else?
No, I was very interested in this poem that you regret writing, because I don't know what this poem is about. Maybe you do. How come?
why do you regret it now?
I regret the poem because the poem is not the right message to send out for the current political climate.
But could you describe what the poem is like?
I think it can be found online.
Okay. I will Google.
It's basically called Sorry, and Amir, I think it's brilliantly sort of vibrant. Obviously, you know, not all your poems are the same, but it's a kind of its moment, and it says something, it encapsulates a sort of sentiment. It's sorry for bringing couscous, sorry for all the maths we've brought, sorry for everything.
It's that one, yes. I read it.
Yes, yes. It's very, you know, it's out there. I mean, but.
So you've read it?
I've read it. It's, okay. It's reached Sweden, even.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry.
Sorry, the poem or sorry?
Okay. Right. Okay. So, Athena, I first studied as a sculptor, and Giacometti is one of my favourite sculptors. And what I love about his work is the way his mastery is pared down into a few lines or a drawing or pieces of clay, which yet contain everything. And space is also very important in his drawings and where his sculptures sit in space. And I wondered, could you talk a bit about how you wrote White Blight? Was it always so minimalist, or did it start much more wordy and big and you pared it away?
Actually, it's you will hear it shortly. It's a short book.
Did it always start short?
Well, it started out with me for many years being preoccupied with not writing this book. Right. So it took me maybe 4 or 5 years to write it, and I always think that before this process, it took me 5 years not to write it.
Yes.
So I was very sort of preoccupied with avoiding certain issues in my writing. And then, you know, as it sometimes happens in life, the things that you try to avoid, I don't know what it's called in English, but they sort of catch you.
Find their way to the surface.
Yeah. And I felt in order to stop avoiding these issues, I had to sort of formalize a principle for myself. So I wrote a lot, actually, but I decided that only the things that made me very sad when I read them myself, I could keep. Mm. Yes, so that immediately turned into a minimalist principle.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The next question I'm going to have to read, because it's complicated, but I'm also really interested in the way you presented the poem, which is, if people have seen it, it's white type on black strips on a white page, and I've read it described as like dino strips or redacted censored text. And I also want to ask you, because I know you've translated some of the French feminist linguistic philosophers such as Marguerite Duras,
yes.
Whether there's any influence there, because I know she talks about how women write. They translate from the blackness, from the unknown, to create a new way of communicating rather than using an already formed language. And I wonder if you could talk about a bit about your decision to present the poem in this way on the page.
I'm definitely very influenced by the French feminist philosophers, and Hélène Sissou, for instance, is also like has been thinking a lot about sort of the source from which women write. But the book is called Vit Svit, which is a very difficult title to translate. Had I known that it would be translated, maybe I would have chosen another title. But it is about Vit is white in Swedish, and svit is it means many different things. It's svit is like a suite of poetry or a piano suite of Chopin. Or I don't know, but it's also but svit can also mean like the consequences of injuries, like bodily. Mm. So I was very interested in this sort of corporal, spatial and aesthetic aspect of this word put together with whiteness, and this is what the book is about. And I also wanted to represent this graphically. So what the graphic designer did when we worked together was that he sort of translated the poetry into graphic design, which I was very interested in. So we did a collaboration there. It's very nerdy to sort of explain this, but I don't know if you can see, but the book looks like this. So it's like white writing, and I think about it in many different ways, like in a Word document, for instance, when you want to erase something, you mark it before deleting. It could be that, or it could be subtitles, or it could be the Dymo type thing you were talking about. But I think to me it's it's a representation of the darkness necessary for the whiteness in order to become comprehensible for itself.
Interesting. In many of Amir's poems, I sort of think the narrator is present, and I get the sense of being communicated directly. Whereas in your poem, White Light, I sense the narrator is not obviously there. Those of you not familiar with the work, it's written in short, almost sort of aphorisms, but with a sort of twist, off-key twist, and in a number of different family members' voices who each express different and often contradictory opinions about their experience of migration. And although your characters obviously appear just to speak for themselves, of course they don't, because you're the narrator, you're the author, and you're making decisions about what you choose to put into their mouths, and of all the millions of things they say, what you leave out. Mm. And I'm just wondering, is your character as a family member there in the poem? And can you talk about your voice as the poet and where you sit?
Well, I think in some senses this could be read as a very polyphone, is that what you say in English? As a poetry with polyphony. But with many different voices, the family members talking. But in another sense, there's only one person speaking, saying that this person said and the other person said. And as you were saying, if you say that if I sit here and say, Amir says this, it doesn't necessarily mean that he does. But to me, that was a choice in order to represent the experiences of migration and revolution and war and racism, which the book is about, in a complex way. So I would say that the I or the narrator is the only person speaking and never speaks at the same time and is the person spoken about. Right. So, yeah. But the poem is also about this, about sort of the responsibilities of narrating.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. And there's just one sort of last thing I thought, we could talk about all of us, all three of us sort of writing in the immigration debate, which is kind of obviously toxic for a lot of, you know, people and at the moment particularly. And I just wonder, because as poets we obviously, you know, we're meticulous about the accuracy of the words we use, and, you know, and I just wonder what responsibility you think as poets we have when to speak and when to be silent. From my own experience, I live in an area in Wembley which is 99.9% non-ethnically English, white English. And I love it. I find it really dynamic and, you know, just so interesting a place to be. You know, it's so sort of alive and vibrant. But I'm conscious that I could present that, the same facts, in two completely different ways, you know, as positive or negative, or somebody could. And I just wondering how we, what sort of responsibility we feel, when to be silent, when to speak, and what sort of constraints there are on us, whether it's political correctness or can we criticise our own communities, and what you feel about that.
Well, it's a very big question.
I know.
And a very important question as well. But I think, I mean, I think first of all, it's very important to talk about responsibility when it comes to poetry.
Yes.
I'm sometimes very tired of the fact that, you know, or the idea that anything goes because it's art. Yes. To me, it's a way of saying that art doesn't mean anything because it doesn't affect the world. So I think it's very important for everybody who works with a material, no matter what material it is, to actually be responsible of that, the effect of their work. And our material is language. Silence, I mean, silence can be understood in many different ways, of course. I think my strategy towards silence is writing about silence. And specifically writing about the question that you raise, whether or not something can be written about or not. You know, because I feel like in my work, I always reach that question somehow, you know, and that question is somehow a wall in front of me all the time. Can I write this? Can I not write this? What do I do with my responsibility towards this group, towards myself, towards this experience, this history, this idea of society, this future? And I'm sure you know. And I, you know, I think that could be, all these thoughts could be very difficult to, I mean, it could also make you not write, right?
Yes.
So my strategy is sort of to deal with these issues in poetry, because I think that is also my material. I mean, what makes you, what makes writing difficult for somebody, I think should always be at the center of their writing, somehow.
I think I agree with that, but it's a very long, sometimes painful process, that cell, that checklist. What does this poem do to the community, or what does it do to this place? What does it do to me? What does it do to X, Y, and Z, and all that? And often it's difficult to get a complete answer for everything, but things pop up all the time, whether individuals or ideas or anything else. But poets, usually they have a habit of being naughty in societies, but they always try to be cultural physicians, and that's sometimes confusing, the role of the poet with the cultural physician. They think they can cure some illnesses in the culture or something like that, but yeah, they can sometimes, but other times it's difficult. So
It's this makes me think of a line from the American poet Adrienne Rich that I've been translating. She has a poem called North American Time that I often return to. It's like some sort of a poetic political manifesto of some sort, and she says, It doesn't matter what you think. She speaks to herself as a poet, and she says, it doesn't matter what you think. Words are found responsible. All you can do is choose them or choose to remain silent, or you never had a choice, which is why the words that do stand become responsible, and this is your privilege.
Yeah, and when becoming known and a poet and the name, then it's becoming more the responsibility, and it's becoming more that checklist, it's becoming longer and longer. That's
especially for someone like you who's claimed asylum in the UK, because obviously your words, you've got to think about how they could affect relatives and family, you know, back, you know, in Syria or wherever as well. You know, there's many more layers of concerns that you would have somebody writing here, I'm sure, than for me writing, you know.
Yeah, and thankfully I haven't got anyone back home, well, back in Syria. There's none of my family members out there, so I don't have that worry. But I know some people, they have that worry, and they cannot write for certain reasons, that their family members are still there.
I think we should hear some of your poetry.
Yeah?
Yeah. Okay. That's really...
So... can everybody hear me? Okay. I've got a few poems, and I've got also an abstract from a short story. I'll start with the short story, the abstract. It's about a single Syrian mother who decided to take what the Syrian immigrants, they call the journey of death, from Syria to Europe with her 10-year-old son, Ahmed. Dawn. It's a third night here, middle of nowhere, mountain, sea spot. Mom, let's go back home. Now 10 times that same question. No. Will Daddy come later? Yes. With toys? Not sure. Might send toys first, then he comes. Yahoo! As Ahmed questions me, Sharif, the smuggler, gives yet another dirty look towards my hips as I lean to pick the phone. Olive trees spread around like a palm full of seeds and open to share with others. White wild dog with the black spots limps away. Name, Sharif asks. Summer. We'll set off tonight, Summer. That's if lifeguards, not there. Okay. I am in that tent if you need anything. The only thing I need of Sharif, as he understands it, is sex. He eyes me up ever since arrival to Istanbul from Aleppo a week ago. All the way here, tries to speak, touch, even pretends to accidentally fall over me. Sometimes the waterproof jacket I wear is almost penetrable by Sharif's dark eyes where he sees boobs. Freud writes about these characters. Sharif's nose, the dirtiest to come across in life so far. In right ring finger, wedding ring with diamond line, God helps his wife, and God knows how she accepts him with that attitude and look. Smaller group like ours, better than a larger crowd, says Sharif confidently. Since our first meet, Sharif wears same white stripy shirt, same black trousers, same black shoes, even same line of dirt on right shoe. Few white hair and beard, more in eyebrows. Middle-aged Sharif digs head in a black leather jacket and only speaks to women in the group. The bad news, I am an only woman here. My eyes are swollen. Their large size now double, but in an ugly way. Their brown color must have darkened with dust. No mirror around, so I cannot see. Thought thicker eyebrows were better for eyes protection, but not for mine. Last time I remember not to cry was a few days before I left my husband Jabal back in Aleppo. That was the day to know Ahmed and I are to travel without him. Started to cry then, yet to stop. Sharif wanted too much money, so Jabal chose to send us away from war into safety. Ultimate sacrifice to put family before self, loved ones before I. That night, Jabal switches TV on Al Jazeera. "Look," he says, "the world in a mess. What makes you and I any better? Strange how some people come, live, then go without the question, how did I learn that?" Some see Jabal selfish to send us on journey of death, to put our lives at risk. I see Jabal the perfect husband. The heart. Heart is home. Love knocks its door, comes in, sits on floor, looks from window to see lovers pass, then weeps. I give it my hand, then say, "Don't be upset. Though you love itself, still you need love. Come on in, I am your home. Stay that way. You and heart stitch into each other. Midst of it you sit, hand on cheek, lilac in hair, eyes half closed. Stay that way, stagnant, deep in heart. Poetry and I. Deep in forest, I see a stream. By its side, poetry sits. I sigh in relief and sit, put a hand across its shoulder and say, "Never I feel home like here, next to you. I see every detail in life." Poetry replies, "What to say? My heart big to fit everyone, including this stream. Here its water inside me flow. I am also at home like this, happy with who I am." Dear love, I got your postcard. It reads, "Sorry, I'm no longer with you. Kind regards, love." Fine. Let's see if you can manage without you sneak into my bed at night and whisper, "Let's make love." Can you really give up the gaze into window as the moon disappears into our eyes? How did you arrive to that decision? Drunk, maybe, you wrote those letters. Gone the days of Mozart to wake you and send you to sleep in my arms. Gone the time you flew into my heart to shelter you in winter, dry, then place you near the chimney of my thoughts. If I ever see love, if I ever see love wandering alone, I will take it in, make the heart its home and the eyes its window to the world. I'll keep it there forever and ever and ever. Close love. If chemicals move, the kiss between lovers get close to strike. Hands find their way around the body. Eyes shut themselves slow. Throat swallow love thoughts. Love is closer than you ever think. A lover is someone to see the core, polish when in need, put a flower in the hair, walk slow, then kiss goodnight. And the last poem is very much to the theme of the event. It's an attempt to answer the question that immigrants face in their countries of arrival when they are asked, where do you come from? From the earth I come, to the earth I come. From the heart of Africa, from the kidneys of Asia. From India with the spices I come. From a deep Amazonian forest. From a Tibetan meadow I come. From an ivory land, from far, from everywhere around me, from where there are trees, mountains, rivers, and seas, from here, there, from everywhere, from the womb of the Mediterranean I come, from a mental scar, from closed borders, from a camp with 1,000 tents, from shores with Alan the Kurd I come. From a bullet wound. From the face of a lone child. From a single mother's sigh. From a cut in an inflatable boat about to sink. From a bottle of water for 50 to share. From frozen snot in a toddler's nose. From a tear on a father's cheek. From a hungry stomach, from a graffiti that reads, I was here once, from another when a tree says, I love life, from a missing limb, like a human, with everything I come to share the space. Thank you very much.
Min familj anlände hit i en marxistisk idétradition. Min mor fyllde genast huset med prydnadstomtar, vägde plastgranens för- och nackdelar mot varandra som om problemet vore hennes. På dagarna skilde hon mellan långa och korta vokaler som om ljuden som kom ur hennes mun kunde tvätta olivoljan ur huden. Min mor lät blekmedlet rinna genom syntaxen. På andra sidan skiljetecknet blev hennes stavelser vitare än en norrländsk vinter. Min mor byggde oss en framtid av livskvantitet. I förortsvillans källarförråd radade hon upp konservburkar som inför ett krig. På kvällarna letade hon recept och skalade potatis som om det var hennes historia som fanns chiffrerad i Janssons frestelse. Tänk att jag sög på de brösten. Tänk att hon stoppade sitt barbari i min mun. My family arrived here in a Marxist tradition. My mother immediately filled the house with Santa knickknacks, weighed the pros and the cons of the plastic Christmas tree as if the problem were hers. During the day, she distinguished between long and short vowels, as if the sounds that came out of her mouth could wash the olive oil from her skin. My mother let bleach run through her syntax. On the other side of punctuation, her syllables became whiter than a winter in Norrland. My mother built us a future consisting of quantity of life. In the suburban basement, she lined up canned goods as if preparing for a war. In the evenings, she searched for recipes and peeled potatoes, as if it were her history inscribed in the Jansson's temptation casserole. To think that I sucked at those breasts, to think that she put her barbarism in my mouth. Min mor sa, det verkar som att det aldrig föresvävat dig att det är ditt namn civilisationen stammar. Min mor sa, mörkret i min mage är det enda mörker du behärskar. My mother said, it seems it has never occurred to you that it is from your name civilization descends. My mother said, the darkness in my belly is the only darkness you command. My mother said, you are a dreamer born to turn straight eyes aslant. My mother said, if you could regard the circumstances as extenuating, you would let me off easier. My mother said, never underestimate the trouble people will take to formulate truths possible for them to bear. My mother said, you were not fit to live even from the start. My mother said, a woman dug out her mother's eyes with her fingers so the mother would be spared the sight of the daughter's decline. My father said, you have a tendency towards metaphysics. Still, I schooled you in the means of production when your milk teeth were intact. My mother said, your father lived for the day of judgment. So did your mother, but she was forced to other ambitions. My mother said, in your father's sleep, you are executed together. In your father's dream, you form a genealogy of revolutionaries. My father said, your mother fed you with imported silver spoons. Your mother was everywhere in your face, frantically combed out the curls. My mother said, for a lifetime I envied your father's traumas until I realized that my own were far more remarkable. My mother said, I have spent a fortune on your piano lessons, but at my funeral you will refuse to play. My mother took the dream out of my father's hand and said, all this sugar will not make you sweeter. Walk a lap around the house before you take the insulin. My father said, I have lived my life, I have lived my life, I have done my share. Now nothing remains of the halcyon days of youth. My mother said to my brother, be aware of strangers. Remember that you have nothing to return to should they become dangerous. My brother said, I had such a strange dream that dawn died in my eyes before sleep had cleared. A humanity of sugar and slaughter. When I bid farewell to the light, I knew everything. Min mor sa, ur cellernas delning, ur ett genetiskt material, ur din fars huvud, men inte ur mig. Min far sa, ur civilisationernas kamp, ur en grundläggande antagonism. Ur mitt trötta huvud, men inte ur henne. My mother said, from the division of cells, from a genetic material, from your father's head, but not from me. My father said, from the clash of civilizations, from a fundamental antagonism, from my tired head, but not from her. My father said, if it were possible to compete in martyrdom, your mother would do everything to lose. My mother said, the heart is not like the knee that can be bent at will. My father said, even the rooster who does not crow gets to see the sunrise. My mother said, but if the hen does not lay an egg, she will be served for dinner. My father said, your brother shaved before his beard started to grow. Your brother saw the terrorist's face in the mirror and wanted a flat iron for Christmas. My brother said, someday I want to die in a country where people can pronounce my name. My brother said, do not think it is in your power to offer me anything. My father said, whose father are you rendering? My mother said, whose mother are you rendering? My brother said, whose brother is being referred to? My grandmother said, if you don't finish chopping the vegetables soon, there won't be any dinner. My father said, to those who have, more will be given, and from those who lack, even more will be taken. My mother said, take some more milk before it turns. My mother said, wouldn't it be strange to feel a single night like this one, my language in your mouth? Min far sa, en sked för bödlarna, en sked för befriarna, en sked för de hungrande massorna och en sked för mig. My father said, one spoonful for the executioners, one spoonful for the emancipators, one spoonful for the hungry masses, and one spoonful for me. My mother handed the glass to her mother and said, now we're even, here is the milk back. My grandmother said, your mother descends from the rising sun. She was named after the flower bud since she was born in spring. Your mother named you after a warrior to prepare you for winter. My grandmother said, during spring in Maracachu, mint grew along the streams. Does the poem you're writing reveal any of this? My grandmother said, you snot-nosed little mutt. Come here and I'll take your measurements and knit you a wool sweater. My mother said, if we meet again, we will not let on that we knew each other when you were hungry and it was I who carried the milk. My brother said, black milk of dawn, we drink you at night. My brother said, the past is an assault never to be completed. My mother said, write like this. For my opportunities, my mother sacrificed everything. I must be worthy of her. Everything I write will be true. My grandmother said, write like this. Mothers and languages resemble each other in that they incessantly lie about everything. Min mor sa, skriv så här. För mina utsikters skull offrade min mor allt. Jag måste bli henne värdig. Allt jag skriver ska vara sant. Min mormor sa, skriv så här. Mödrar och språk liknar varandra i det att de oupphörligen ljuger om allt. Min mor sa, alla familjer har sina berättelser, men för att de ska fram krävs någon med en särskild vilja att vanställa. Min mor sa, du förvanskar skadan med din olyckliga lögn. Det finns en stumhet som inte kan översättas. Min bror sa, det är alltid något ofullkomligt som förblir ofrånkomligt. Det är alltid något ofullständigt som fattas. My mother said, your family will never recover from the lie that binds. My father said, your family will never return to the rooftops when it cools down. My brother said, your family will never be resurrected like roses after a fire. My grandmother said, there's a time for everything under the sun, time to return to the rooftops when it cools down. My grandmother said, pistachios for the toothless, rosaries for the godless, rugs for the homeless, and a mother for you. My father said, jobs for the jobless, wages for the wageless, papers for the paperless, and a father for you. My brother said, cables for the wireless, organs for the bodyless, transfusions for the heartless and a brother for you. My mother said, oxygen for the lifeless, vitamins for the listless, prothesis for the limbless, and a language for you. My mother said, I will reclaim what belongs to me. You will meet death robbed of language. Speechless you came, speechless you will return.
I want to express my thanks.